towards the end, I had such bad panic attacks that I would turn up shaking, you know, and they were horrendous, them panic attacks. I've never forgotten them. But they're what saved my life. You know, if that hadn't have happened, if my body hadn't collapsed, if it hadn't have given in and given me away, I don't think I'd have stopped. I think I'd have carried on.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfall. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today we have an amazing guest called Carly, who I've known for many, many years. She's now 20 years sober. She got sober at the age of 24. We discussed that that's quite young and how that was. Carly talks about panic attacks that saved her life and talks about how sometimes she finds it difficult to do life on life's terms today, but recognises how being honest with herself in recovery and giving herself a break is really important. Carly works with Stride Foundation, bringing our program to schools to help kids with resilience, awareness about addiction, peer pressure and self-esteem. Carly, thank you so much for coming on This Is Powerful.
You're welcome.
Much appreciate your time.
And time.
How sober are you now?
I am 20 years sober.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
Thank you.
How old was you when you got sober?
I was 24. It was in 2005.
That's pretty young.
Very young. When I think back now as well, like who I was surrounded by and the friendships I had at the time, the social circles, it was quite a big thing.
You must have been probably the only person in your circles or that you knew.
If I compared myself to others, which at the time I did, there were certainly those that were either felt like they were worse than me or was on the same level, but no one was seeking help or in the kind of place where I was in the end, you know, where they were kind of going to medical professionals to get help, you know. they were kind of still going.
You were clearly a legend out of the group.
Apparently so. I think so. I think I got the name Hoover once.
Did
of
you?
Someone, yeah, which is not something we need to be too proud of. But, it kind of gives you an indication to
what drugs you was using as well. I'd love to go back to the beginning.
Sure.
Where you're from and how was your upbringing?
So I was from a place in Newham called Beckton. My family originally came from the Isle of Dogs and my dad's side came from Tottenham. So we moved there and I had my brother with me who's about 18 months younger than me and we grew up together there and I didn't leave there until I was 27. So I'd done most of my childhood there.
So you're an East London girl. So how was your upbringing though? A lot of generalising, but a lot of people say in East London it is quite tough.
I'd agree. And I think I can only really speak for myself and my interpretation of it. You know, I think there was this element of where you couldn't be soft and gentle. And this is how I felt. You know, it was very much you didn't talk about fluffy things like your feelings, you know, and you didn't really talk about anything spiritual, God, you know, you kind of had to be tough, you know. And I lived in an environment where, you know, girls were aggressive, you know, and they would fight, like the boys as well. And I feel sad about it, really, because I think now I look back with hindsight, there was no other language to be used. It was either you stuck up for yourself or you had to fight your way out of a situation, you know. And I don't know where that came from and how that evolved, you know, but that was definitely the experience that I had, you know. And it was a council kind of estate sort of thing. A lot of people that I mixed with, their parents were either together, but we were low income, we were working class. you know, my mum was a single mum in the end. She later got a partner, but there was a time when things were difficult. So we didn't have lots of things. It was very much kind of like shell suits, and people would come off the back of lorries with loads of stuff and you'd buy them, like Naff Naff and Benetton, you know, and they were never really the labels from the high streets. They were knockoffs.
Truck labels.
Yeah, truck labels. And they were amazing, right, because it was so cheap, you know. So you could kind of portray that you were keeping up with the appearance, but you actually couldn't afford to do so, you know, and that kind of started a narrative, I think.
It's really funny. Like, we've got quite a few viewers in America. It'd be like Betson's kind of like Brooklyn, I think, like Red Hook in Brooklyn. It's a place just over the bridge. And it was funny about East London. I read something the other day that until, I think it was early 2000s, that it was the only place that UPS wouldn't deliver because they'd rob and blow up the trucks. Oh, wow. Even though they'd go to like really hostile places. So I think it got a bit of a... A reputation for that.
Yeah.
So even though it was low income and quite rough, I would imagine. Mm. Did you have a nice upbringing? Was it a good upbringing?
Yeah, I would say that I'd count myself lucky, you know, that I had a very loving family, you know, who tried their best, I think, in the circumstances they had to steer me in the right direction. You know, we were very tight knit. My uncles and aunts all lived 2 miles from each other. So I could literally walk in the house and help myself in the fridge. You know, they'd come to mine, and just cousins would show up in and out of our house all the time. And we spent Christmases together. We'd done everything together. We socialised together, you know, much to my dismay at times, you know, because it was quite chaotic. I even remember, like, on Sundays, we used to go to a social club. And then everyone would kind of end up around someone's house from that social club on a Sunday. And that party would go on. That's my memory of it anyway. I'm not sure if that actually existed, but as far as I can remember, that's what we'd done. And we spent a lot of the time down that social club. And there were great times, you know, dancing, and a lot of memories of my dad are there, you know, and yeah. So I count myself as lucky in that sense, you know. My mum was, once my dad and her separated, when I was about 8, she was a cleaner. She had to try and manage things herself, you know, and she was on benefits, you know, and she'd done amazingly well. When I think back now, you know, the 3 jobs she had, and it really would be kind of like me coming home from school, cleaning, cooking, looking after my brother until she could come home. And I would have said that was probably around like the 11, 12 age onwards. You know, I can recall cooking dinners, you know, and then everyone coming in, you know. So I kind of took on this adult role that wasn't really there for me to have, you know. But
was that a good thing or a bad thing?
I'd say it was a negative. I don't think it was intentional from my mum. I think it was circumstantial. But, you know, looking back now, that young girl, that was too much. You know, that was too much to really do. And whilst I learned some fabulous skills to cook and clean, and I think that kind of developed into a thing for me, because even now I really want to keep everything clean all the time. You know, I used to care about people showing up. I remember living in a flat once when I was like 24, 25, and I live on my own, but I kept it clean in case anyone visited. No one ever did, but just in case they showed up. But I was like making sure it was clean, you know. So I don't know whether that came from that or it kind of evolved into that. But I don't think my mum sat me down, and she was a cleaner. I don't think she made me feel that way. And I don't have any memories of her telling me to clean a certain way.
Yeah.
But I obviously, you know, encompass something, right? I internalise something.
When did you first take a drink? Because you used to go to social clubs. She was aware of alcohol. Mm. Was you aware that it was a bad thing or a good thing, or was it just there?
I was aware that it was something used on a regular basis, because everyone went every Sunday, every Friday, you know, and we spent a lot of our time there. So, I do have memories of family arguments. There were so many arguments, always at the end of the night, you know, and it was usually over the kids not getting on, or, you know, but people, or at least my family sometimes, or other members that were there, maybe just exaggerated or overreacted in drink, you know, and it can cause quite a lot of conflict. So my relationship with alcohol was very much like I knew what it would do,
right,
you know, at the end of it. I do remember taking my first drink in a Greek restaurant in Ilford, and it was a pineapple Malibu. And I sat with my family. They obviously had this intention to teach me how to drink well. And I sat and I drank it and I didn't really feel anything. And I was like, that didn't make any sense.
How old was you then?
I think maybe 17 or 18, college
years. Oh, okay, so they waited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lie. No, I definitely drank before that.
Right.
So I remember now drinking in the park with my mates and rolling down a hill, drinking White Lightning. I'm sure I'd done that.
That's good stuff.
That we waited, yeah, we chose well. Yeah. And going to parties and turning up with drinking 50-50. Do you remember 50-50? There was this drink where it's 50% of the, God knows what it was in it. And I never really sipped, you know, we downed it and I remember turning up for this party. It was a 16th birthday party and I was sick before I even got through the door and my dad had to come and pick me up.
Was that part of like the kids or the people going to the social club that would drink on their own? Or was it, because some people really want to belong and drink and some people just want to drink?
I think there was definitely a need to belong. If I was in a group of people or friendships and they was all doing it, I would definitely join in. All the time. You know, if you're drinking that, I'll drink it with you. I don't think I initially knew at that point that I was developing an addiction at any point, you know, at that time. I think it was this sense of, I want to do that. And I was quite spontaneous. And I had this kind of mantra and often told, you never think before you act. You know, so I would kind of do now, think later sort of thing.
I've heard that line many times in my ear.
And it didn't serve me well, you know. It kind of did serve me well for a while because it gave me the ability to go into things that maybe other people wouldn't have the guts to do, like job interviews or, you know, walking into situations where people meeting new people. But I suppose thinking back now, you know, I think there was a need to belong to. I remember even this time when they had Tippex or glue and they were sniffing it, but they were lying, it weren't real, and they gave it to me. And I think I acted like I was out of it just to be part of that little group, which amazes me now to think that I would do such a thing, you know, but I do remember doing that.
To be honest, I remember when I was 7 and there was an older group of guys in the neighbourhood and I was friends with Barry at the news agents. And he used to give me a tick, so I'd go in there. I could just walk in there and think I was a legend by going, oh, can I have a Mars bar, please? And he would just put it on a bit of paper. So I liked the idea of having this credit thing. And the older guys weren't allowed to buy cigarettes. And you could buy singles at the time. So I was like, I can get them. So I made friends. I'd get cigarettes for them. They'd give me one of them. And I would try to smoke it, hold it in my mouth, because I didn't want to inhale it because it made me feel sick, but just to belong, which is... You know, when I look back, it's sad because my kids are that age. But that was a real desire to belong.
And I think when I think about memories like that, how dangerous it could have been, you know, the vulnerability that I had, you know, and that I was lucky that I was surrounded by people that didn't go too far.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been a lot different, right, if I'd have got in with the wrong people.
You seem to have like a fond memory of that period of time because, you know, if you have addiction or alcoholism, it doesn't always strike till later on down the line. Did you start getting to drugs before the alcohol took hold or what was that timeline?
I was going out drinking with friends and I had a fabulous time. We used to go out and drink in Romford and we would go to all these different bars and we had a male group of friends and there was us and we kind of merged and it was honestly, I think it was a fabulous time. And it was shots and, you know, but I remember going into the bar and my friends, we'd have glasses of wine before we even went. So we didn't even drink when we was out. It started early, you know, and I would go up and we'd ask for a vodka Smirnoff Ice and an apple shot. And I'd done the apple shot first, downed the Smirnoff Ice and then we'd get another drink.
Right.
Not all of them would do that, but I would, that was the kind of thing. And I remember that feeling, because I was quite confident as a young person. I was chatty. I wasn't perceived as someone that was shy or would struggle without drink. You know, I could go into a social situation and chat. But there was something about going in that place for the first couple of minutes and my belly would go over and then I'd have that drink and then suddenly I would just feel a warmth. And then the rest of it just carried on. I never questioned. I never thought for one second, am I drinking too much or should I drink this type of alcohol? I've never checked the volume. I don't know about you, but I only checked volume in the end if it was strong. I never actually checked in the sense, is it safe?
Never. I would have just done it. I remember we went to Mallorca on a holiday and I lined up 10 Sambuca shots, lit them and then drunk them all. Because it was just a thing to do without any forward thinking of I'm going to be sick or I'm going to be hammered. But I think that came with age,
mm.
you know, to know about volumes and stuff like that. Because
mm.
for me, in the end, I was trying to get it right just to be able to drink but not get completely blottoed for like quite some time, you know.
Mm. And that was a struggle, right? Trying to do that.
Yeah, for a period of time it was.
Mm.
But that's when I found, obviously, cocaine.
Mm.
So having a nickname of Hoover at points... Oh, how did good. You get into...
Sorry, Mum.
How did you get into cocaine?
So I think... No, I know. It started in a wine bar in Cannon Town and I went out with a group of friends and we decided to share a wrap because back then they were called wraps. I get confused now when people say tickets. I'm like, what's a ticket? But we shared it. We must have had a small amount each. And the impact of that in that toilet, I remember greatly. It kind of shot up and then my brain came alive. And it just felt like there was nothing I couldn't say or do in that moment that I was frightened of. I was just literally amazed in that moment by that feeling and thinking to myself, but I've always been confident, but this is another level of confidence, you know. And it stopped me worrying about going out and talking to boys, being around other people, socialising, dancing, you know. And it was never intended to become what it did. You know, it was supposed to be a social drug, something fun in a party, you know. And
which it was. That was known
it was.
For a social
that's
drug.
That's what it
right?
was known as. And that's how it began. And I literally wouldn't touch it again until we had an event or a night out together where we would go out and do it. But
you said about being confident in different areas and talking to people. And a lot of people who have addiction are quite shy or introverted.
Mm.
And to do that and then have the result of actually, this is another level.
Mm. I think it shows as well how confident I actually was. I think it shows the truth that maybe I had this facade that I was confident. And you have to remember, for me, in my kind of dynamic and household, there was sometimes a lot of sadness. My mum experienced, you know, the loss of her mum. I remember that affecting her quite greatly. My dad and my mum separated. There was lots of big traumas. We lost, my mum lost a nephew, a baby. My aunt and uncle lost their baby when he was like 8 days old. So there was a lot of memory around, you know, and I think I just learned in their moments to make everything okay, you know. So I'd sing, dance, whatever I could. And I think that just taught me to just how to mask anything that I had. But the truth was, I was confident on the outside, but I really cared about what other people thought of me all the time. You know, confidence is a strange thing because it's perceived if you can just show up in front of people and be a loud person, that's confidence. I don't think that's confidence anymore. For me, confidence now is more about, can I be quiet and be content in my own skin around everyone, regardless of what's happening? You know, and that's something I strive for now, but it didn't come easily to me.
Obviously, things started to get bad at one point with drink and drugs, I'm assuming, or one or the other.
Mm.
When did you first notice there was possibly an issue?
When I got my own. We used to go out in groups and everyone were kind of... There were some of my friends that didn't. You know, there were some of my friends that absolutely was against it and stayed away from it and, you know, rightly so for them. And they tried to kind of... They noticed there was a change in the group, where we were going, the clubs, the scenes we were around. Suddenly we were going to places we'd swore we'd never go to. And I started to get my own before I met everyone. So I would pick up from a dealer and I would put it in my pocket and I would use that before even arriving to the group when we were at one house getting ready.
Without telling them?
Without telling them, no, I ain't going to share. Like, I was never telling anyone, you know. And I didn't see that as an issue. I saw that as intelligent. I was kind of like, of course that's smart, because I hated sharing, you know. And there was times when you were sharing, I was watching how many you had, you know, and the size of your line to mine. And, you know, it all seemed funny at the time, a joke, but I was becoming very kind of focused on that.
And it's an expense.
A massive expense, you know, and I was thankful, I was lucky to be working at the time and, you know, I had a good job and I had a good income, so I was able to finance it, you know, and we had a lovely life and we kind of spend this Saturday going out shopping, eating breakfast in lovely lunches, you know, and buying our outfits for the evening. And then this night would come and they've all gone home and had dinner and kind of like a relaxing bath or whatever and then got ready and I'm ringing a dealer to get drugs driving my car, you know, completely I mean, back then, it wasn't known for drug driving, you know, but I certainly done it. And I'm so grateful that I didn't kill anyone else before myself, because, you know, I'm a mum now. I drive around with kids, and the thought of knowing that someone could be on the road in that moment, you know, unpredictable, you know, is scary, you know, so I acknowledge that.
Where were you working at the time?
I was in Canary Wharf. I was in an investment bank, and I'd started in there in 2001. And I'd gotten that job, and it was fabulous, and I'd met people, and I was doing well, and there was a big drinking culture. We started in Liverpool Street, and then we moved to Canary Wharf about 6 months later. And at that time, it was very normal to go out at lunchtimes and have a drink. You went out with your team. There wasn't that much drugs, so I have to say, within the kind of place that I was working or the environment that I was in, but it was very much seen as a drinking culture. And then after, I'd go out after work, which started off like, you know, the Thursday and Friday, where the Thursday was an odd night. Then it was like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then you went out on a Tuesday. And then before, you know, it was out 7 days a week. There was somewhere open 7 days a week to go, you know. And
was that with your work colleagues, or you went out with your friends after?
I think I started with my work colleagues and I probably just escaped and disappeared. And then when I met my other friends, you know, or they would meet me out, my friends, with my work colleagues, or would meet up the city, and then it would just move on, you know. And the smart ones went home, Paul.
Yeah.
They went home for work the next day, and I just didn't.
That's what they told you.
Mm, true.
So did it affect your work at any point?
At the beginning, it was a weekend thing. I tell you what changed the most was my attitude. My attitude started to change, and I was becoming more aggressive and more flippant with things, and also unpredictable, because I'd kind of be okay 1 minute and then I felt like I would just be like shouting and getting annoyed, you know. And I watched people's faces. I do remember them kind of looking to set up, and they noticed. They would make comments like, "What's wrong with you? You're all right." I'd be like, "I'm fine. You know, what are you going on about?"
Do you think that's because lack of sleep as well? It's just like your liver with all these substances.
Yeah, definitely lack of sleep. I mean, I wasn't. By the time it got really bad, I didn't sleep. It was kind of broken sleep, maybe for a couple of hours a night. I mean, I remember ringing my boss. I'd overslept, and he said, "Where are you?" And I was like, "I don't know. Like, I've been at a party and I've just come back." And like, he said, "You're supposed to be in work an hour ago." And he was amazing, you know, that he tried so hard to encourage me to get into the help, you know, and to seek out. He did. He was really, really great. He was like a father figure to me at the time. He kind of sought me into the support system within the employee program, and that was what took me into treatment, you know. And I'm forever grateful to him today, and actually my team that was around me at the time, they were all rallying for me, you know. They could see that I'd gone from being this young girl, and you do kind of develop this kind of family unit in a team when you're working together. I feel we had an employment program that supported that, but at the time there was so much else happening. So my mum was going through breast cancer at the time. She'd just gotten into remission in 2001, but all of that was really fueling it, you know. And what a great excuse, right, to say, "Well, I'm not coming in today," or "What I'm struggling with," you know. And it saddens me that I use that as an excuse, you know, but it was the reality that it was a get out clause, you know, to many. And yeah, and I think they, after me trying to see doctors, GPs within the company, eventually going to see psychologists, I was up Harley Street. You know, we tried everything first, acupunctures, drink diaries.
All through work?
All through, yeah, that was, so I started in 2001 and I got through to recovery really in 2005. So for that 4 years, probably from 2002 onwards, it was that quick.
Wow.
You know, it didn't take long for me, and I'm forever grateful for that. But at the time, it just felt like it went from naught to 100 really quickly.
So they supported you through the whole, that period?
The employee program did, yeah, and the That's company amazing. Did. Yeah, they did. And I originally went in because it was what was believed that I was suicidal. Right. And I was on antidepressants, and they knew about the issues with my mum. So they, you know, that's what I was deemed as, depressed, and I didn't tell anyone. You know, I didn't tell any of the treatment centres or the psychologists or all the doctors that were trying to help me.
Was that your reality at the time, though? Because I know people use things as excuses, but they see that in hindsight.
Mm.
But when you're in that drama of life, it actually does seem real. Was that your reality at the time?
I thought I was dying. Like, I didn't understand what was going on. You know, I knew that I'd taken something. I knew what I was doing, but I didn't know what I was doing. And I remember saying to doctors and my GP especially, like, I know something's wrong, but I don't know what it is. And when she would ask me the question, like, do you take any drugs? No, you know, definitely not. And she was prescribing me Valiums, antidepressants, Zopiclone for sleeping tablets, Coproximal for painkiller. Like, I had so much stuff because I'd manipulated it out of her. You know, she was desperately trying to help me and she was baffled. She was looking at me going, I don't know what's, like, through her book, like, I don't know what's wrong with you, you know. And I just kept saying that I was sad, you know, and I needed help. And towards the end, I had such bad panic attacks that I would turn up shaking, you know, and they were horrendous, them panic attacks. I've never forgotten them. But they're what saved my life. You know, if that hadn't have happened, if my body hadn't collapsed, if it hadn't given in and given me away, I don't think I'd have stopped. I think I'd have carried on.
What happens in a panic attack for people who don't know what a panic attack is?
So for me, it was instant. It was, I was fine 1 minute, and then the next thing I knew, I felt like I was dying. The heart was pounding. My body shook violently. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't grasp a breath. And it felt like a rabbit in headlights. You know, I was looking at people going, what's happening? And it frightened me and it frightened everyone else, you know, but it just wouldn't go away. And even when I sat in front of medical professionals and they were saying, you're fine, you're okay, I was like, no, I'm not, you know, because they were checking, they check your heart monitor, they do all your pulse and your vitals and they were all normal, but I wasn't, you know. And I failed to mention again that the substances that were in my body. And it wasn't just like I was doing it now and again. This was like from morning all the way through the day, you know. And it blows me away that I actually thought medically my body would never collapse under that, as if it would be okay. And it's
so that's
normal.
Basically using through the whole day, 24/7.
So my daily, what I'd come to, and I would take all the prescription medication that was given to me, and then I would swear, and this is what a lot of people talk about in recovery, right, is like, today is going to be different. You know, I'm not going to do it today. And I meant it. I thought, I've had enough. I cannot take this no more. It needs to end. And that was probably at 9 o'clock. By 10, I'm ringing the dealer. By 10. You know, and then I spend the whole day buying bits and then saying, I'm only going to have that much. You sure? I don't make 4 trips. No, just that. I'll be fine. And then another call. And then another call. And I don't even know how I funded it sometimes. You know, I was writing check guarantee cards, you know, in debt. The money that I got, I mean, I was paid well for my job and it was gone within a week after payday.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's insane. And it blows my mind that I thought no one noticed that. Like it went unseen, you know, because when I see it now, I'm like, oh, that's really obvious, isn't it? Like your jaw's moving and, you know, but I was absolutely convinced that no one knew, you know, and I raged around supermarkets, like sometimes completely off my head. And I dare to think what them poor people came across, you know, with a basket.
Basket, like, case.
I don't even know what I was doing, you know. And I just, there's so many memories that you recall, you know, of people seeing you for what you are. And you're kind of like going, I'm going to ignore that, you know, that what's wrong with them, you know, and they're off their head, them people, you know, and just kind of going into one. And
I find it fascinating that when you see someone in recovery for a long period of time, you'd have no clue, like physically, emotionally, mentally, that you was like that.
No.
It's crazy, right?
And that's the compliment to recovery, right?
Yeah.
That I need to look the opposite to what I was. And I think the anonymity was important at the beginning, right? But I kind of wish someone took a video of me talking and the way I was compared to now, you know, because it is hard for people to believe it. And I'm glad that I'm not the same person. You know, I've still, one of my biggest fears when I came into recovery, or at least introduced into recovery, was who am I going to become?
Yeah.
What does this mean? You know, because
it's a valid question.
Yeah, there was parts of me that I didn't like, but there was loads of parts of me that I actually did like. And the things that I relied on, that kind of chatty Carly and that girl that could make friends, you know, if you make her quiet, what does that mean? You know, and And I was frightened of what I was going to become. Would I become boring? Would I just sit around? I was convinced that I was going to sit in an armchair, watch Coronation Street and do nothing. That's what I thought recovery was going to be like, you know. And it was irrelevant, really, because I was already stuck in a room for 24 hours a day, not going anywhere anyway. Yeah. But yet the opposite, that would have been an improvement, right, even on where I was. But even like things like, I can still remember, I said this the other day, I remember snorting a line, putting it in the drawer like I was not going to go back to it and trying to go to sleep with the belief system after a stimulant that I'm going to get to sleep, like it's going to help me relax. Like that insanity is mental, that the whole thought process around addiction is insane, you know. And when I talk about it to friends or, you know, to like, you know, to young people now, I say to them, you know, you're not who you think you are when you're in addiction. You know, you're still yourself, but it's like this other version of you comes out and you don't even recognise it. And it just takes over.
Yeah.
You know, it really does. And it's so painful to watch hurt so many people, like families and, you know, that get destroyed through this. But I think that's the hardest thing to grapple with, right? Is this still the same person? Do they love me? You know, my mum would look at me and go, why are you doing this? You know, when are you going to stop? And I've wrote her letters. I'm going to stop soon, I promise. You know, and she went from being the mum that was dragging me to every single like professional she could, in the end saying, do you know what? I'm done. You're out. Like you need to leave. And I was like, she's going to chuck me out. Like then where am I going to go? But she was in every right to do so. But as a parent now, I empathise with the fact of how hard that must have been to make that decision, you know, knowing that you do everything for your children and that you live to protect them. You know, it's the one thing she couldn't fix.
God, must be so, so painful. What was the final straw?
The final straw, there was two things. One of them was physical. So what happened to me was that my tongue spontaneously just come out. It wouldn't go back in and I was like almost biting down on my tongue.
Right.
And it was so horrifying and frightening that the only thing that would stop it was Valium. Psychologically now, I think subconsciously I was probably trying to do that to get more.
Yeah.
But it felt like I was out of control. And also I had a wooden spoon in my mouth a lot towards the end.
To
keep my tongue in place. And that's how I went into treatment the second time. I strolled through. The first time I went in and I had sunglasses on, a wheelie case. I was done up. Like I was going for like a spa or something, you know, and I've heard you share about it before, you know, like the kind of realisation when you get in there is like, where do you think you, like the windows are locked shut, screwed down.
Yeah.
They put me on observations. So observations would mean they didn't trust me to be left alone for longer than 20 minutes to 30 minutes at a time. So I had a nurse that was on standby outside that would come into my room. There was no lock. It was completely open. And they would check if I was breathing, if I was, you know, still alive, if I was safe, you know. Because I think I didn't even realise that time how unsafe I was, how unpredictable I was. And it wasn't until I went in there and everything was taken away that I realised really how painful it was to let go of the drugs. You know, it really felt physical and it felt the pain of like the headaches and the shaking and trying. There was no let up. It was pure torture, you know. And I'm grateful to those individuals now that do that job, because that's a difficult role, right? Because you maybe go into the wrong room on the wrong day and maybe you see something you don't want to see.
Yeah. And when you was in there the second time, did you have a moment of clarity where you're like, I actually need to recover from this addiction?
Yeah, I did. I think when I was in there, I mucked about a lot. I didn't take it very seriously. I went and self-tanned. I don't even know how I got that in. Self-tanning. We pack that.
As long as I look good on my suicide watch, I'll be fine. Yeah.
So I roll in the first day with like a wooden spoon in my mouth and like everyone going, what the hell? By day two, I'm hair's done, makeup's on, you know. And I remember distinctively sitting in like this group circle and looking at this girl and going, you're really in trouble. You're on heroin, you're fucked, you know. And her just kind of going, yeah, I know. And the therapist kind of going, whoa, hello.
Yeah, excuse like, me, Mrs. Yeah. Tan. What's going on?
What's going on over there, you know. And I'm thankful. I think that it was about 3 weeks in. And I remember, for me, I wasn't very good with group work because I didn't like to show everyone the truth. I liked to hide. I was okay one-on-one, I'd be honest then. But what they'd done was, and I'm really grateful now, is they kind of went in on me a little bit and they challenged me. And they started questioning how much I knew and how okay I was. And because I was in front of people, I got really angry. How dare you? Let's talk about him. Let's talk about her. What about him? You know, and I tried so hard to get everyone off. That deflection thing we do. But I cracked. And I cracked so badly that I broke down.
Yeah.
And then I remember one of the therapists saying, and this is the real Carly.
Wow.
And I kind of looked up and I remember everyone's faces just kind of, and I thought I must have put on a really good show because everyone looked shocked, you know, that the real version of me was quite small. Yeah. It was quite childlike. And I broke down, and that was about a week before. And I think then I said, but I'm leaving in a week. And then it dawned on me that everything still existed and the bubble was going to burst and the panic set in a little bit. But it was good panic. It was the panic of, you need to start listening now, Carly, and start taking advice because this don't last forever. And I think I just got caught up in, I liked being looked after. I'd put myself in rehab. Look, I think it's a great place. You know, I'd go in every week, go, I'm here, you know, but the reality is that's not life. You can't live in there, you know, and yeah, and that I'm forever grateful for that breakdown. Thank God for that collapse.
Breakthrough, really, isn't it?
Breakthrough, yeah. Breakthrough of in, let's stop letting everyone see what I want. I think they want them to see.
Yeah.
And start showing them that sometimes I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not all together. And actually, I'm quite small and scared. You know, I don't know how to get myself out of this situation. And it was the first time I think that I started to feel softer and lighter, you know. Yeah. And then I started to pay, I wouldn't say a great amount, because I'd love to say that I was like, yes, you know, I still fought it quite a bit, but I was at least teachable at that point.
Yeah.
My ears were open.
Honesty is a power, and vulnerability is a power, because it takes one person to say their truth. And I can't speak for everybody, but I've noticed that people go, oh, thank God you said that, because I feel the same. Mm. Oh, okay, thank you. And it changes the energy, doesn't it?
100%. It gives permission to other people to just go, okay, so there's no need to be like that. You know, and a lot of the time when I'm speaking now, very rawly and very bluntly, you know, I'm careful about who and when and what time I say it, but, you know, I think it makes a difference to say, even with all this recovery, over all this time and all this work, there are days when I struggle. There are days when I don't think I can do it another day. You know, not so much around drink and drugs. That's really removed now. Mm. It's more about mentally and emotionally and spiritually. Can I really cope being a mum today? You know, can I really show up as a wife, you know, and can I be there for myself, you know, and some days I have to just give myself a break and say, it's okay, you don't have to be that person today, you know, and there are other days where I'm really strong and really confident and I'm really grateful for it, you know, but the good outweighs the bad, you know, there's no shame for me anymore in showing vulnerability. I don't mind people seeing me, you know, at my worst. It's not easy. I still find it hard crying in front of people, I admit. I'm not very good at that still, but I can hold space.
It's not a trade or an art, though, is it, to cry in front of people?
Exactly.
Unless you're on stage.
Well, yeah, and there's not much chance of that. But I'm definitely good at holding space for others now. You know, when things used to get emotional and difficult, I used to get very uncomfortable and I used to want to leave the room or make it better and fix the problem immediately, you know. But now I'm very much kind of like, just crack, you know. And I think allowing myself to be a bit more softer, a little bit more less harder on myself, I'm easier on others, which is the irony, right? The better I am on myself, the more of a chance I'll give you.
It makes sense, because the more you have, the more tolerance you have and capacity for other people.
Mm.
So after you went into treatment, you've been in recovery and you've done lots of work in recovery. Mm. You changed careers and went into schools, right?
I did, yeah.
It's an important subject, because Stride Foundation goes in and does school talks, and we're building other parts to our program, and hopefully through funding to expand. What did you see in your experience in schools? What's going on with kids around drugs or phones or vaping?
Yes.
Can you give us a little insight on that?
Absolutely. So I got a majority of my time really in primary schools to begin with, and the pastoral side was where I aimed for supporting teachers with emotional literacy and kind of family support. And in that, there was so much struggles for children where their parents, you know, one parent, it could be an uncle, could be an aunt, where they're in active alcoholism or addiction, you know, and some of them are quiet. They're saying nothing. They're just in school getting on with it. you know, and you wouldn't even know. And the night before, the police could have been at their door, yeah. you know, with a domestic violence fight, you know. And that was really interesting for me, seeing the resilience that they hold, you know, but also trying to engage with the children and the families to get them to come together and catching the kids first, you know, and kind of working with them and letting them understand that, do you understand what anger is? Do you understand what frustration is and how to label the emotions and then how to have strategies to help them get through it? But at that age, they are so young, you know, that it, you're kind of really only touching the iceberg. When
How old are they?
So they're in between the ages of 5 and 11, 10, 11.
Listen.
You know, and they're amazing, absolutely amazing. But where the real work changed for me was when I went to secondary schools. So I left the role I was in inner London, in Havering, and I went into a secondary school where I live now in Northwest Essex. And, oh, my God, it changed me forever. When I went in, because I had the primary school experience, with children in primary school, you said hello, they said hello back. They just trust you immediately. Secondary school, absolutely not. I was coming in going, smile, morning. They were like, who are you? Like, and then I realised you don't just get them to talk to you. You have to earn the trust and respect of these kids. Yeah. You know, they won't just give anything away. So I invested in lots of baubles and custard creams and I had a pot on my desk. And one by one, it got them to come and speak to me, you know. And it was very slow at the beginning, trying to build the relationships. And you have to work hard at this. You know, you have to really kind of speak to these kids and say to them, I'm listening, I'm here. And they'll give you a little bit here and there, you know, about their struggles and what's going on. And slowly but surely, as you build the rapport and the trust, they start opening up. And there is like, vaping is beyond. You know, for me, vaping is the most dangerous because it can be hidden more. And the messages that they hear, it's better than cigarettes, it's safer.
Yeah,
you know, so they kind of see it as, you know, I'm not harming myself. And then when you say, but if when I'm 18, I can go and buy it. I can vape normally. It's not a problem. But why is it now? You know, why do you care? And for a lot of those, you know, I was trying to explain to them that it's one thing experimenting, right? But you're coming into your school day and you're taking yourself out of your education to hide to do it. That's an issue, yeah. right? So there's a lot of kids becoming addicted to these things, you know, and...
Do you think it's addicted to the behaviour of it rather than the vaping?
Yeah. I'm not sure they're getting it. I think some of them have slight nicotine, maybe. But generally, I think it's more about the facade to begin with, the joining in, the belonging. Because a lot of young people went in, kind of done it for a little bit, then went, no, that's not for me, and went and back to their education. Then there were certain groups that didn't, you know. But now there's THC vapes. There's pink cocaine, which is laced with heroin, cocaine, weed, all in one vape. And they can actively walk into a toilet. Wow. It doesn't smell of anything. It smells nice, like a perfume. So they can do that and walk about their business. And it's actually generally quite hard with teenagers, unless they're really obvious, because they're smart. They keep away from you. Yeah. They don't come near you, you know. And
also, I guess if they're heightened or they're angry, it's a teenage behaviour.
It's just how they are, right? They always break, you know, blow up and overreact, you know. Not all teenagers are doing that, I have to say, but... There is a big, large group of them, you know.
So was your job role there to help those kids with relationships with the parents and themselves? What was the actual...
So my primary role at that school was to work with the students and to give them emotional support outside of their education. So if they were struggling with things at home, maybe they were worried and stressed about exams, friendships, relationships, I was there as like someone they could come to and speak to about that. And what I found was... and it wasn't that all of them didn't have good homes either. It wasn't that their parents weren't trying or engaging with schools. Some of the parents are amazing of these kids, but I think they felt different about talking to someone that wasn't in their family unit and it wasn't a teacher, you know. And the first, what you got to report, miss? What do you need to report? And I had to be really honest with them and say to them, you know, there is a level, a line, you know, that I have to keep you safe and me safe. You know, and I do have to report if you're not safe and if you're using things illegally, you know, because that's duty bound, you know, and you might not understand it, but it's important that you know that I'm a safe adult and I'm here to help you. And they would toy around the information and they got so clever. They'd come in and go, what if my friend Harry, or what if my friend Charlie done this? You know, what would you say? I'd report it, you know, and we'd kind of laugh and joke.
So it must have felt safe to say that in the first place.
Absolutely, because I built that. Yeah. I built the knowledge of them coming in, the trust that they knew that you come in my room, nothing's off guard. If you need my help, if you need me to protect you, I'm in. I will do whatever I can. And I have to state as well, there are so many staff members, teachers that are doing really, really amazing jobs at trying to keep kids safe as well.
Yeah.
But it's a really hard world to be in at the moment. There's no resources, there's no funding. The external services are overwhelmed. There's waiting lists beyond, which is why STRI is so important, right? Because there's a gap. There's a bit where they come and they say, I'm in trouble, I need your help. And then they can't see anyone for like 4 months, maybe a year. So what do you do in between? The parents are pulling their hair out. They don't know where to turn. Yeah. The generations have changed. Social media in itself is an addiction, you know, and these kids are instant. There's kids selling drugs on TikTok, on Snapchat, openly, you know, and it's just, things are so quick now.
Yeah.
They don't need to go around certain individuals or certain areas like we did as kids to find people. They can just contact someone instantly and get it dropped and brought. You know, and that frightens me.
I won't ask anything specific for anonymity reasons or families or kids. Was there anything that really shocked you? Was there anything that really saddened you?
Yeah. There was one student that I think the world of, and she came up to me yesterday. I visited the school, and she's just, this, not just her, there's a few. They are stuck in this place of they don't know what to do next. And the only thing they know that brings them joy are these drugs. And it's gone beyond a party, a bit of fun. It's become a daily thing, you know, where everything's gone out the window. And I would explain to people, like adults in school, you know, from experience, these kids, sometimes things are so tough for them mentally that the only place they feel happy is in school, which is great, right? Because they're not missing. We know where they are. But the education's not important right now. And that's really hard for teachers because that's what they're there primarily to do, to get you that education. Because the belief system is if you get an education, you don't end up doing nothing and falling into vulnerable situations. You can go and better yourself. And that's where this comes from, this push for education. And I really believe in it. But there are those that can't access it because they're just not able to mentally right now. And I was the same. I was that girl in school that just didn't care enough about the education because it was too much to care. It was too much information. I just could cope just about with friendships and my life at home and stuff like that. Not that it was horrendous, but my mind was overrun, you know, with thought processes and worries and concerns about life and relationships and friendships that, quite frankly, I didn't care about maths or English, you know. And I got that later on in life. That came back and I educated myself. But, you know, I get it why some of these kids don't want to do it. You know, they just want to be left alone almost in school to walk around and do it.
Do you think because you've been through that whole path yourself, then come for a long, long, long recovery and done so much work on yourself, then educated yourself, that gave you the correct toolkit to see and relate to these kids to build a trust and rapport with them?
Yeah, 100%. There is a difference between me and, say, a professional coming in from another establishment with these kids. The difference is, and you'd be the same, and anyone from STRIDE, because of our recovery, when you sit opposite someone and you say to them, I know what it feels like, I can find the humour in their moments when it was so bad, you know. When they found out the 2 days before I was leaving that I was in recovery, they had an inkling because you know too much about drugs, miss, you know. But I told them at the end because I thought it was important that, you know, I didn't kind of, you know, divulge too much. And they said to me, we could talk to you. You know, you're different. And that's how they felt. They felt like you understand what it's like. You've been through it. And I don't feel judged by you, you know, and it's not that practitioners or any teachers are judging, they're not, but it's so hard for someone to identify. It's no different from any other illness like cancer. A cancer survivor can understand another cancer survivor. No matter how much I talk to my mum about it, I'll never really understand what she went through unless she spoke to someone who had the same experience. It's exactly the same, you know, with us, that we can sit opposite each other and we know what it was like to be in their moments. We can empathise. And I think kids really, really, you know, grow towards that. They look at it and go, oh, if you've done it. And the first thing they said to me when I said I was in recovery, but you're a mum. What do you mean you was a drug? You couldn't possibly have been that. Mm. And I was like, well, there you go. Oh, I'm glad you didn't recognise it, you know. And I don't want you to think that I think anything badly about people in addiction because I don't. You know, it was what it was. It happened. Nothing could have been any different. No amount of my life, in my home life, the any dysfunction that it happened to me, my dad leaving my mum, none of that mattered. I was always going to do what I was going to do. That didn't make me an addict. You know, definitely changed my emotional sobriety, definitely changed my relationships and the way I viewed life. But it wasn't the be-all and end-all. You know, well, there's lots of people in life that have gone through really horrific things that have not used drink and drugs, you know. So this was always going to happen to me.
If someone's listening and they're struggling with addiction or they're going down that path or they're supporting someone, what would your advice be for them to do?
I think my main advice would be to just give it a chance. Just listen to somebody, you know. And I know how hard that is when someone's sitting opposite you. And you, I believed at that point that to give it up was giving up me breathing. You know, don't ask me to give up the one thing that makes me happy. That's all that's left. But if you just give someone a chance and see if it works first, and then you can always go back. You know, I think that's the message I'd give, because half the time it's the not even trying and the fight of avoiding that destroys you the most.
Carly, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up, and you can get in touch with us, because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Giulia Ciccolella, Ria Musa, and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.